Hello, and welcome to this edition of Diabetic Health. I'm Eileen Byrne, and I'll be reading to you today from diatribe.org, as well as the American Diabetes Association. Our first article is about foot complications. People with diabetes can develop many different foot problems. Even ordinary problems can get worse and lead to serious complications. Foot problems most often happen when there is nerve damage, also called neuropathy. This can cause tingling, pain, burning or stinging, or weakness in the foot. It can also cause loss of feeling in the foot, so you can injure it and not know it. Poor blood flow or changes in the shape of your feet or toes may also cause problems. Neuropathy. Although it can hurt, diabetic nerve damage can also lessen your ability to feel pain, heat, and cold. Loss of feeling often means you may not feel a foot injury. You could have a tack or stone in your shoe and walk on it all day without knowing. You could get a blister and not feel it. You might not notice a foot injury until the skin breaks down and becomes infected. Nerve damage can also lead to changes in the shape of your feet and toes. Ask your healthcare provider about special therapeutic shoes rather than forcing deformed feet and toes into regular shoes. Skin changes. Diabetes can cause changes in the skin of your foot. At times, your foot may become very dry. The skin may peel and crack. The problem is that the nerves that control the oil and moisture in your foot no longer work. After bathing, dry your feet and seal in the remaining moisture with a thin coat of plain petroleum jelly, an unscented hand cream, or other such products. Do not put oils or creams between your toes. The extra moisture can lead to infection. Also, don't soak your feet. That can dry your skin. Calluses. Calluses occur more often and build up faster on the feet of people with diabetes. This is because there are high-pressure areas under the foot. Too much callus may mean that you will need therapeutic shoes and inserts. Calluses, if not trimmed, get very thick, break down, and turn into ulcers, which are open sores. Never try to cut calluses or corns off yourself. This can lead to ulcers and infection. Let your healthcare provider cut your calluses. Also, do not try to remove calluses and corns with chemical agents. These products can burn your skin. Using a pumice stone every day will help keep calluses under control. It is best to use a pumice stone on wet skin. Put a lotion right after you use the pumice stone. Foot ulcers. Ulcers occur most often on the ball of the foot or on the bottom of the big toe. Ulcers on the sides of the foot are usually due to poorly fitting shoes. Remember, even though some ulcers do not hurt, every ulcer should be seen by your healthcare provider right away. Neglecting ulcers can result in infections, which in turn can lead to the loss of a limb. What your healthcare provider will do varies with your ulcer. Your healthcare provider may take x-rays of your foot to make sure the bone is not infected. The healthcare provider may clean out any dead and infected tissue. You may need to go into the hospital for this. Also, the healthcare provider may culture the wound to find out what type of infection you have and which antibiotic will work best. Keeping off your feet is very important. Walking on an ulcer can make it get larger and force the infection deeper into your foot. Your healthcare provider may put a special shoe, brace, or cast on your foot to protect it. If your ulcer is not healing and your circulation is poor, your healthcare provider may need to refer you to a vascular surgeon. Good diabetes control is important. High blood sugar levels make it hard to fight infection. After the foot ulcer heals, treat your foot carefully. Scar tissue under the healed wound will break down easily. You may need to wear special shoes after the ulcer is healed to protect the area and to prevent the ulcer from returning. Poor circulation. Poor circulation, or blood flow, can make your foot less able to fight infection and to heal. Diabetes causes blood vessels of the foot and leg to narrow and harden. You can control some of the things that cause poor blood flow. Don't smoke. Smoking makes arteries harden faster. Also, follow your healthcare provider's advice for keeping your blood pressure and cholesterol under control. If your feet are cold, you may be tempted to warm them. Unfortunately, if your feet cannot feel heat, it is easy for you to burn them with hot water bottles, or heating pads. The best way to help cold feet is to wear warm socks. Some people feel pain in their calves when walking fast, up a hill, or on a hard surface. This condition is called intermittent claudication. Stopping to rest for a few moments should end the pain. If you have these symptoms, you must stop smoking. Work with your healthcare provider to get started on a walking program. Some people can be helped with medication to improve circulation. Exercise is good for poor circulation. It stimulates blood flow in the legs and feet. Walk in sturdy, good-fitting, comfortable shoes, but don't walk when you have open sores. Amputation. People with diabetes are far more likely to have a foot or leg amputated than other people. The problem? Many people with diabetes have peripheral arterial disease, or PAD, which reduces blood flow to the feet. Also, many people with diabetes have nerve disease, which reduces sensation. Together, these problems make it easy to get ulcers and infection that may lead to amputation. Most amputations are preventable with regular care and proper footwear. For these reasons, take good care of your feet and see your healthcare provider right away about foot problems. Ask about prescription shoes that are covered by Medicare and other insurance. Always follow your healthcare provider's advice when caring for ulcers or other foot problems. One of the biggest threats to your feet is smoking. Smoking affects small blood vessels. It can cause decreased blood flow to the feet and make wounds heal slowly. A lot of people with diabetes who need amputations are smokers. I have another article from the American Diabetes Association. Diabetes and hearing loss. Diabetes and hearing loss are two of America's most widespread health concerns. Nearly 30 million people in the U.S. have diabetes, and an estimated 34.5 million have some type of hearing loss. Those are large groups of people, and it appears there is a lot of overlap between the two. A recent study found that hearing loss is twice as common in people with diabetes as it is in those who don't have the disease. Also, of the 84 million adults in the U.S. who have prediabetes, the rate of hearing loss is 30% higher than in those with normal blood glucose. Right now, we don't know how diabetes is related to hearing loss. It's possible that the high blood glucose levels associated with diabetes cause damage to the small blood vessels in the inner ear, similar to the way in which diabetes can damage the eyes and the kidneys. But more research needs to be done to discover why people with diabetes have a higher rate of hearing loss. Since it can happen slowly, the symptoms of hearing loss can often be hard to notice. In fact, family members and friends sometimes notice the hearing loss before the person experiencing it. Here's a list of some signs of hearing loss. Frequently asking others to repeat themselves. Trouble following conversations that involve more than two people. Thinking that others are mumbling. Problems hearing in noisy places such as busy restaurants. Trouble hearing the voices of women and small children. Turning up the TV or radio volume too loud for others who are nearby. What should I do if I suspect a hearing loss? Talk to your primary care doctor. You may then want to seek help from hearing specialists like an audiologist, a licensed hearing aid dispenser, or a doctor who specializes in hearing problems. From a full hearing exam, you'll learn more about your hearing loss. You will also be told what can be done to treat it. Understanding A1C. This is from the American Diabetes Association website. A1C does it all. It's called the A1C test, and it's a powerhouse. It can identify prediabetes, which raises your risk for diabetes. It can be used to diagnose diabetes, and it's used to monitor how well your diabetes treatment is working over time. It's also a critical step in forming your game plan to manage diabetes with your diabetes care team. The big picture, monitoring treatment. This relatively simple blood test can tell you a lot. The test results give you a picture of your average blood sugar level over the past 2 to 3 months. The higher the levels, the greater your risk of developing diabetes complications. Your doctor will tell you how often you need the A1C test, but usually you'll have the test at least twice a year if you're meeting your treatment goals. If you're not meeting your goals or you change treatments, you may need to get an A1C test more often. So what do the numbers mean? When it comes to the numbers, there's no one-size-fits-all target. A1C target levels can vary by each person's age and other factors, and your target may be different from someone else's. The goal for most adults with diabetes is an A1C that is less than 7%. A1C test results are reported as a percentage. The higher the percentage, the higher your blood sugar levels over the past 2 to 3 months. The A1C test can also be used for diagnosis based on the following guidelines. If your A1C level is between 5.7 and less than 6.5%, your levels have been in the prediabetes range. If you have an A1C level of 6.5% or higher, your levels were in the diabetes range. Finally, A1C is also defined as estimated average glucose, or EAG. Another term you may come across when finding out your A1C is EAG. Your doctor might report your A1C results as EAG. EAG is similar to what you see when monitoring your blood sugar at home on your meter. However, because you are more likely to check your blood sugar in the morning and before meals, your meter readings will likely be lower than your EAG. What is the difference between EAG and the average on my monitor? The A1C test gives you a picture of your average blood glucose, or blood sugar, control for the past 2 to 3 months. The results give you and your diabetes care team a good idea of how well your diabetes treatment plan is working. In some ways, the A1C test is like a baseball player's season batting average. It tells you about a person's overall success. Neither a single day's blood test results nor a single game's batting record gives the same big picture. The A1C test can help you manage your diabetes by confirming self-testing results or blood test results by the doctor, judging whether a treatment plan is working, and showing you how healthy choices can make a difference in diabetes control. Your healthcare provider may report your A1C test result as EAG, which directly correlates to your A1C. EAG may help you understand your A1C value because EAG is reported as the same unit, milligrams per deciliter, that you see through self-monitoring on your meter or CGM. The difference between EAG, A1C, and the average on your monitor. The catch is that EAG, A1C is not the same average glucose level as the average of your readings on the meter. Monitoring measures your blood glucose at a moment in time, whereas EAG A1C represents an average of your glucose levels 24 hours a day, including times when people are less likely to check their blood sugar, for example, post-meal periods of higher blood sugar. People with diabetes are also more likely to check their blood glucose more often when they are low, for example, first thing in the morning and before meals, so the average of readings on their meter is likely to be lower than their EAG. So how does A1C work? Hemoglobin, a protein that links up with glucose, is found inside red blood cells. Its job is to carry oxygen from the lungs to all cells of the body. Glucose enters your red blood cells and links up, or glycates, with molecules of hemoglobin. The more glucose in your blood, the more hemoglobin gets glycated. By measuring the percentage of A1C in the blood, you get an overview of your average blood glucose control for the past few months. Your doctor should measure your A1C level at least twice a year. What's your number? The American Diabetes Association suggests an A1C of 7% for non-pregnant adults, which is an EHE of 154 milligrams per deciliter. But more or less stringent glycemic goals may be appropriate for each individual. Your A1C target is your own. You are unique and you need advice based on your own set of circumstances. If someone who hears your A1C says, your A1C level should be X, Y, or Z, your response can be, I'm working with my doctor and reaching my own safe diabetes target, and it has been customized for my condition. A1C targets often change over time, sometimes decreasing and sometimes increasing. It all depends on the person and circumstances. Don't compare yourself to your child and to others. Know your goals and be clear, persistent, and honest with your approach to managing diabetes. Your diabetes care team is there to help. Never avoid going to see your healthcare team because you feel like a failure or are afraid of disappointing them. The members of your diabetes care team are your coaches. They understand there are multiple life challenges that influence diabetes each day and night. Life is always changing, and you or your child will need support along the way. This is all part of the process of living with diabetes. Our next article is from diatribe.org. Sleep-deprived teens, a neglected diabetes landmine. This article is by Divya Gopasetti. The importance of sleep for teens with diabetes, plus key sleep strategies from young adults living with diabetes. Being a teenager brings many challenges. Keeping up with schoolwork, dealing with peer pressure, and finding community, changing hormones, applying to college, working a first job, and more. This can be a difficult and stressful time. Teens with diabetes must navigate blood sugars on top of it all. With so much going on, it's easy to deprioritize one of the most essential diabetes habits, sleep. Children and adolescents with diabetes report poorer sleep quality. Studies show that they spend more time in stage 2, or lighter sleep, and less time in stage 3, deeper sleep, than people without diabetes, likely due to overnight hassles, high and low blood sugars, checking blood glucose, and technology interruptions. Sleep is currently in a crisis in teens and adolescents, and this can make blood sugar harder to manage at an already hard time. How much sleep do I need? There's a chart here for sleep recommendations from the National Sleep Foundation. School-aged children, 6 to 13 years, should have 9 to 11 hours sleep. Teenagers, 14 to 17 years, should have 8 to 10 hours. Young adults, 18 to 25 years, should have 7 to 9 hours. And adults, 26 to 64, should have 7 to 9 hours. As you can see, teens need more sleep than adults. However, on average, teens only get about 7 hours of sleep per night. It is natural for teenagers to not be able to fall asleep before 11 p.m. However, this brings a real challenge. Many schools start extremely early. This, combined with pressure from schoolwork and time-consuming after-school extracurriculars, can make it difficult for teens to get the recommended 8 to 10 hours of sleep. How can I improve my sleep? Strategies from teens with diabetes. With the expertise of young adults living with diabetes type 1 and prediabetes specifically, we've consolidated the following strategies for better sleep. Avoid diabetes food landmines by understanding your individual blood glucose patterns and trends. Choose low-carb snacks if you decide to eat late at night. Alondra Zambrano, a college student living with type 1 diabetes, tells us that late-night snacking was hard to completely avoid in college. Instead, she's found tasty low-carb alternatives like olives, nuts, cheeses, that won't dramatically impact her blood glucose levels. Think ahead to minimize the number of disturbances at night. Wear automated insulin delivery, AID, if it's accessible to you. AID systems like Medtronic's MiniMed 670G and Tandem's Basal IQ system have algorithms that take over decision-making and are linked to lower number of highs and low events at night. Keep your blood glucose meter and your hypoglycemia food, like juice boxes, glucose tablets, next to your bed. Panaya Benjamin, a college student with type 1 diabetes, explained, quote, "If I end up having to go to the kitchen at night, I run the risk of overeating," unquote. Adjust your diabetes technology alarm settings so you are not as likely to be disturbed. Sarah Loebner, a young adult living with type 1 diabetes, gives herself a little extra wiggle room with her hyperglycemia alert. For example, using a 200 milligram per deciliter alert at night versus 150 milligram per deciliter during the day, so that she has fewer alarms at night. Jamie, who uses the DIY AID system loop, points out that not all AID systems give you the flexibility to set target ranges. Calibrate your sensor right before going to bed. Panaya shares, quote, "If using a CGM that needs calibration, calibrate it right before going to bed to avoid the disturbance in the middle of the night," unquote. Use night shift mode on Apple devices, night mode on Android devices, and F-Lux on your computer to reduce the amount of blue light exposure from screens before going to bed. Experts recommend avoiding screen time within 60 minutes of bed, as light exposure can disturb the body's natural melatonin production. Melatonin is a hormone that regulates sleep and wake cycles. Remove disruptive technology from the bedroom. Teens who leave devices on, like phones, computers, and television, are estimated to get 30 minutes less sleep on school nights than those who never leave devices on. Dr. Walker described that removing technology from the bedroom, for example, charging your phone in a different room, is the single best thing you can do to improve sleep. Prioritize high-quality sleep as much as possible. In school, there may be pressures to stay up late to hang out or finish homework assignments. Sleep will improve your diabetes management, overall health, and learning. Sarah says that, for her, long nights lead to high resistant-to-bolusing blood glucose values for the next 12 to 24 hours. She said that she had to learn that the hard way, that sleep is important for overall physical and mental health and for keeping blood glucose values in range, which are huge factors for how she felt during the day. Find your motivation to prioritize sleep. A college student living with prediabetes was told that her healthcare provider that sleep loss can lead to weight gain. A lack of sleep also makes it much harder to lose weight. However, she was not told that there was a distinct and direct connection with insulin resistance and her prediabetes. Knowing that she can battle her prediabetes with more quality sleep is motivation for her to prioritize sleep, even as a busy college student. Sleep will help you perform better in all aspects of life. Quote, "At 11 p.m., if I have to choose between studying one more hour for a test and going to sleep, I go to sleep," unquote. Jamie has found that prioritizing sleep will help you perform better on tests, sports, and extracurricular activities, and spend quality time with your friends and family. Here's an article from the American Diabetes Association website under their gestational diabetes section, Treatment and Perspective. Because gestational diabetes can hurt you and your baby, it is critical to start treatment quickly. Treatment for gestational diabetes aims to keep blood glucose levels equal to those of pregnant women who don't have gestational diabetes. The treatment always includes special meal plans and scheduled physical activity, and it may also include daily blood glucose testing and insulin injections. If you're testing your blood glucose, the American Diabetes Association suggests the following targets for women who develop gestational diabetes during pregnancy: more or less stringent glycemic goals may be appropriate for each individual. Before a meal, 95 milligrams per deciliter or less. 1 hour after a meal, 140 milligrams per deciliter or less. And 2 hours after a meal, 120 milligrams per deciliter or less. If you're diagnosed with gestational diabetes, you will need help from your doctor, nurse educator, and other members of your healthcare team so that your treatment can change as needed. For you, as the mother-to-be, proper treatment helps lower the risk of a cesarean section birth that very large babies may require. Sticking with your treatment plan will give you a healthy pregnancy and birth and may help your baby avoid poor health in the future. Keeping worry in perspective. While gestational diabetes can be a cause for concern, the good news is that you and your healthcare team, your doctor, obstetrician, nurse educator, and dietitian, work together to lower your high blood glucose levels, and this will help. And you can in turn turn your concern into a healthy pregnancy for you and a healthy start for your baby. Gestational diabetes usually goes away after pregnancy, but once you've had gestational diabetes, your chances are 2 in 3 that it will return in future pregnancies. In a few women, however, pregnancy uncovers type 1 or type 2 diabetes. It is hard to tell whether these women have gestational diabetes or have just started showing their diabetes during pregnancy, but they will need to continue diabetes treatment after pregnancy. Many women who have gestational diabetes go on to develop type 2 diabetes years later. There seems to be a link between the tendency to have gestational diabetes and type 2 diabetes, since both involve insulin resistance. However, certain basic lifestyle changes may help prevent diabetes after gestational diabetes. Lower your risk by losing weight. Are you more than 20% over your ideal body weight? Losing even a few pounds can help you avoid developing type 2 diabetes. Follow simple daily guidelines like eating a variety of foods, including fresh fruits and vegetables, limiting fat intake to 30% or less of daily calories, and watching your portion sizes. Healthy eating habits can go a long way in preventing diabetes and other health problems. Regular exercise allows your body to use glucose without extra insulin. This helps combat insulin resistance and is what makes exercise helpful to people with diabetes. However, it is important to check with your doctor before starting an exercise plan.